Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show where we discuss a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, today we've got another field trip for you. In fact, we've got the second installment of our field trip to Philadelphia. Those of you who were listening just a couple of weeks ago will recall that the first part of the field trip concentrated on Independence Hall itself, sort of the epicenter, the birthplace of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And we had the pleasure of going through there with Ranger Adam Duncan of the National Park Service. But we had such a great time with Adam, and we went into such detail that we only got through Independence Hall itself. And we didn't have time to talk about all the other important buildings right there adjacent to Independence Hall. So that's what we're going to do primarily today. We're going to go through Congress Hall, which was the original meeting place of Congress from 1790 to about 1800, and where lots of important things happened during that first decade of our federal independence, or not independence, our federal existence after we adopted the Constitution. Then we're going to go right down the street to where the Supreme Court met for the first decade of its existence. And then we're going to go to a place that you may never have heard of, but which was extremely important in our early constitutional history, a place called the Second Bank of the United States. The Second Bank of the United States. Did you even know that there was a First Bank of the United States? Well, we'll talk about that and why it's important a little bit later on. But we're going to start at a modern building. And the modern building where we're going to start is across Independence Mall from Independence Hall. It's a place called the National Constitution Center. And we went there more or less at the beginning of our visit to Philadelphia. And one of the people there is going to tell us just why Philadelphia is so important. Okay, we're here with Steve Frank of the National Constitution Center. And Steve is going to tell us all about the importance of the city of Philadelphia to our constitutional history.
Well, Stuart, as you mentioned, the city of Philadelphia is not only the place where the Declaration of Independence was written, but also the place where the Constitution was written. And in fact, it was written just two blocks away from where we're sitting right now in Independence Hall, which was then known as the Pennsylvania State House.
In the very same room where the Declaration of Independence had been written just before, had been adopted just a few years before.
In the Assembly Room,
right.
Yes. And Philadelphians were, you know, enormously important to that process. Benjamin Franklin, the greatest Philadelphian, of course, was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention.
And the founder with whom you would most like to have a beer.
Absolutely.
No question. All right.
But there were other delegates as well from Pennsylvania who played an enormously consequential role. Gouverneur Morris, who was actually the draftsman of the Constitution, put it into final form, and probably had more to say than anyone else at the convention.
He's sometimes credited with writing the preamble pretty much himself, isn't he?
That's my understanding, that he did.
I mean, there were all these resolutions that were passed, and someone had to reduce them to written form, and that was primarily his job. It fell to him to do that, and I think that the story I hear is that he essentially said, "Well, you know, we got to introduce this thing." And mm-hmm. So maybe he's the guy that actually came up with that famous phrase, "We the people."
Well, there were various drafts, uh-huh. And as you probably know, some of the earlier drafts were not "We the people." It was "We the people of the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts," and finally, as a kind of literary form of artistry, and also as a political statement, because he didn't know whether every one of those states would ratify the Constitution. It was condensed into "We the People," and what a difference that made.
Oh, yes, yes, artistically, poetically, and very significant constitutionally, as you know.
Absolutely.
But we won't get into too much detail about that yet. So you had Gouverneur Morris, you had Ben Franklin. Who else from Philadelphia was important?
James Wilson was enormously important. He was probably the most prominent lawyer in America at the time. And he also spoke a great deal at the convention, probably next to Gouverneur Morris, the most of any single delegate. And he probably had a deeper understanding of popular sovereignty, self-government, than any delegate besides James Madison.
Isn't he often described as the most brilliant man at the convention, with the possible exception of James Madison?
Perhaps.
Yeah, I've heard that description.
That's a big exception.
That's a big exception. But he's certainly considered among the most learned in the law,
yes,
and the smartest. And in fact, isn't he often credited with pretty much writing Article III?
Yes.
Yeah. And then he went on, of course, to do great things, including founding the University of Pennsylvania Law School, or at least doing a series of law lectures that the Penn Law School traces its history back to.
Mm-hmm. So for all those reasons, you know, Philadelphia, Philadelphians, Pennsylvania, was enormously important. It was, you know, the largest, well, perhaps not, it was about the same size as New York at the time, but certainly the most cosmopolitan city in the country at the time that the Constitution was written.
Mm-hmm.
A city of perhaps 30,000 people.
Right. And then, of course, after the Constitution was written, after it was ratified, then many people don't realize Philadelphia was our national capital for about a decade, right?
Between 1790 and 1800.
Right. The great compromise that was reached up in the original capital, which was New York City, involved as one part of it, putting the capital here in Philadelphia for 10 years while they constructed what they called the Federal City, and we now call Washington, D.C. And my understanding is that Philadelphians really liked that deal because they figure, you know, once they come here, they're never going to leave. And they built Congress Hall, and they built a presidential mansion, and they're thinking, yeah, come on, you know, it's nice here in Philadelphia, just stay here. That didn't work out, though, did it?
No, but it's a very typical Philadelphia feeling. I feel that same way about the city. Why would anybody want to leave?
Why would anybody want to leave? Absolutely. Okay. Well, so lots of important constitutional things happened here. I imagine the drafting and the eventual adoption of the first 10 amendments, we call the Bill of Rights, was all accomplished right there in Congress Hall, wasn't it?
They were adopted when Congress was meeting in Congress Hall. They were probably proposed in New York by Madison, but certainly adopted and became part of the Constitution while Philadelphia was capital of the United States.
Right. They were ratified in 1791, so that would have been a year into Philadelphia's status here. Okay, and so that's obviously another very important part of the constitutional significance of Philadelphia, but I imagine there have been things that have happened since 1791 that are significant to the Constitution in this city as well.
Well, before we go to post-1791, the Constitution had to be ratified after it was written.
Oh, sure.
And certainly the debates in the Pennsylvania State House where James Wilson made the case for the Constitution were enormously consequential. A lot of the arguments that he used were then picked up upon by the Constitution's friends, the Federalists, in other states to make the case for the Constitution.
That was very important because, if I recall correctly now, Pennsylvania was among the early states to adopt the Constitution. Delaware beat Pennsylvania.
Delaware was first, Pennsylvania was second.
In December, right? Yeah. December of 1787. And by its own terms, the Constitution needed 9 states to ratify before the Constitution went into effect. So the people who were up front and who adopted things first were obviously setting an example. So you're saying James Wilson's arguments in the ratification debates, right back there in Independence Hall up on the second floor, were influential in the other state ratification debates, were they?
Absolutely.
Now, did Ben Franklin also participate in that ratification discussion?
Franklin died a couple of years after the convention. He was a pretty sick man by the time, you know, aged and frail at the convention. I don't believe he had a really large role in the ratification, but I don't know that for sure.
But everybody knew where he stood.
Absolutely.
And so he certainly stood, if somewhat silent, as a proponent of that during that time. Okay, so ratification, very important. Ratification, of course, and the adoption of the Bill of Rights in 1791, very important. But constitutional history doesn't stop in the 18th century here, does it?
No, it doesn't. It continues. I'm not as well versed in the subsequent history as some others might be, but certainly Philadelphia has played an instrumental role through the Civil War. There was a great deal of manufacturing that was happening here that equipped the Union Army. Pennsylvania sent many troops to serve in the Union, and of course the turning point of the war was at Gettysburg, not too far from here. But Philadelphia has played an enormous role.
And in fact, I just learned yesterday that Abraham Lincoln came here and gave a very important speech about the American experiment during the Civil War and how important the Union was. And he also laid in state here in Independence Hall.
He did.
And I had not realized that. It was a bit of a gap in my knowledge. So people tend to come back to Philadelphia whenever the Constitution is front and center in their minds, whenever that it arises as an issue. In fact, I think pretty much every sitting president of the United States has come here to Philadelphia and specifically to Independence Hall while he's been in office.
And now we'd like them to come to the National Constitution Center.
Well, maybe President Obama will hear this broadcast, and would you like to invite him officially?
We would officially like to invite him back. He was here during the campaign for president in 2008. He was actually here twice. He delivered his really remarkable speech on race here at the Constitution Center
yes.
in March.
That was very important, yes.
Of 2008. And he came back in April and debated Hillary Clinton, which was the final primary debate of the campaign. We'd love to have him back now that he's president.
We certainly would. Well, I say we. You certainly would. As a citizen, I second that idea. I'd like to have the Secretary of State come back, too.
Absolutely.
Secretary Clinton come back as well. Okay, anything else you want to add about the importance of Philadelphia, or have we pretty much covered it?
I think we've covered it.
Okay, well, once again, Steve Frank of the National Constitution Center, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing your exhibits.
Thanks for visiting, Stuart.
All right.
Now, the National Constitution Center is worthy of an entire episode all in itself. And guess what? We're going to do that in a few weeks. But right now, we're going to go back to Independence Hall, or I should say back to right next to Independence Hall, where we go into Congress Hall with Ranger Adam Duncan of the National Park Service.
We're standing on the steps of Congress Hall, so you can hear the city street in the background. Adam was about to tell me a really interesting story about something that happened during the 1790s when Philadelphia was our nation's capital. And remember, the first capital was New York, and then we moved here in 1790. With the expectation that we would ultimately move to the new federal city in 1800. So we're talking about the 1790s. Now, what happened, Adam?
Well, here on the steps, the Speaker of the House, then Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg, was stepping out. And they had just finished up some very, very heated debate. And going on through the country, there was some issues about the Jay Treaty.
Jay Treaty was a very controversial treaty, I think 1795, wasn't it?
That's correct.
And it was where we were attempting to make a more permanent peace with Britain because the Treaty of Paris in 1783 had left a lot of things unresolved, or at least it wasn't being followed very well. And so Jay was sent over by President Washington to see if he could settle these affairs. And when he came back, he had a treaty, but a lot of people thought he'd given away too much. So that was a very controversial thing.
Well, Speaker Muhlenberg steps out here, and his brother-in-law actually stabbed him.
His brother?
It was not fatal. It was not fatal. They got into a fight.
Well, was it about the Jay Treaty?
From all accounts that I've read, yes.
You have a brother-in-law stabbing the Speaker of the House of Representatives of the United States because he doesn't like a treaty.
Yeah, and it's possible there was more to it that doesn't get captured in the record.
Right.
Right here on this
spot. It happened right here on this spot, but he did survive the attack.
He did.
What happened to the brother-in-law?
I never followed up on that.
Okay, if you find out sometime, let us know.
I will.
All right, we're inside Congress Hall, which is the building in Philadelphia that served as effectively our Capitol building where Congress met during the 1790s when Philadelphia was our nation's capital. It's often overlooked by a lot of people, but here it is, and it's another beautiful building with a semicircular chamber with the seats all around a central dais, and I'm standing here again with Ranger Adam Duncan.
Now, we're in the House of Representatives chamber. Originally, the House would have been a little bit smaller because, remember, we do the census. So they expand the building by 26 additional feet in the summer of 1794. We're also in the room where George Washington stepped down as President of the United States and where President John Adams took the oath of office, which is right here in front of the the speaker's platform or the dais.
Oh, that is so exciting because, you know, a lot of people have commented that the turnover of the executive power that happens in our country every 4 or 8 years is among the most inspiring moments in all of our normal governmental activity, because it really is an extraordinary thing for any president to willingly step down, any head of state to willingly step down. And we do it every 4 or every 8 years. And this is the very first turnover of the executive power.
It was. And there were a lot of foreign visitors that day over the visitors platform that we see behind us who were there. And I imagine they were probably a bit curious, waiting for the military to come in and make George Washington stay in power, or kill off John Adams or something.
Right. That's typically what happens in history. Yeah. When someone runs, at the end of a term comes, they suddenly decide that maybe it's not a good idea. Maybe that they're more important than people realize. And George Washington, of course, was notable for that. In fact, wasn't it King George once who said that when Washington surrendered his commission at the end of the Revolution and gave up the opportunity to be the king of the United States, George III, the king of England, said that if that's true, then he's the greatest man in the world, or greatest man in history, something to that effect. And so here's where he finally gave up the presidency as well.
Yes, and the story goes is that Thomas Jefferson was just standing off to his right, and everybody had been accustomed to letting Washington go first. I mean, it's the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, the president of the United States. So Jefferson is waiting for Washington to leave, and he kind of motions to Jefferson as, "You go." And so they kind of have this back and forth. So John Adams goes, walks out, and Jefferson follows, and then George Washington behind him.
Wow, very symbolic.
And it's also up on the balcony outside where George Washington greeted a crowd that had gathered after he steps down, too.
He was the rock star of the late 18th, early 19th century.
If Washington's a rock star, Franklin would at least be the drummer in the band. Between those two, absolutely.
I see. Now, is this also where the famous exchange supposedly took place between Washington and Adams, where Washington said something like, "I'm well out of it and you're in it"?
Yeah, it's actually Adams that captures in his diary. He says, "I looked at George Washington and his face, his expression, it was like he was saying to me, 'I am fairly out and you are fairly in. Let's see which one of us is the happiest.'"
Oh, I know who was happier at that point. Boy, oh boy. But Washington wanted nothing more than to retire back to Mount Vernon. Pretty much, I think,
his entire life.
Certainly, I think once things went poorly in the Revolution, and they simply wouldn't let him do it. But finally, this is where he finally said, "I'm going home."
He goes home. He lives about 3 more years, and he passes away in December of 1799.
How old was he at that point?
I believe he was 67.
Yeah, that's a shame. He didn't get to live a few more years and enjoy Mount Vernon a bit more.
He did not. Just 3 years retirement, which is certainly not enough.
No, it wasn't enough. But that's just the way it goes. Okay, anything else about Congress Hall?
Let's go upstairs and see the Senate chamber.
I look forward to it.
Here on the second floor, you're going to see a big difference between the House of Representatives chamber and the U.S. Senate chamber. Mostly in coloration, mostly in material furniture, because remember, it's the upper house. It's the more elite side of the government, depending on who you would ask, certainly.
Ask any senator, they would have said that, sure.
Yeah. And they're appointed by states. Back then, the vice president was here presiding over for every single session.
Yeah, John Adams actually came over here and presided, didn't he?
As well as Thomas Jefferson.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You were telling me a story about this hallway we're standing in. It used to be a room. And what happened here?
Well, just about halfway down the hallway was the room, was the old Senate chamber. Because we add new states, three in the 1790s, Vermont, Kentucky, and Tennessee, not only does the House grow because of that, more population, but also the census, but the Senate grows. So they actually had to add on 26 feet to the building. Mm-hmm. So the room kind of gets pushed back with the addition. But George Washington was inaugurated here on the second floor in the U.S. Senate chamber for his second term as president.
Now, his first one was, the first time he took the oath of office was in New York.
New York.
So this was the second
Federal
inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very interesting. All right. In fact, wasn't this also the place where John Adams entertained a lengthy discussion in the Senate about how the president was to be addressed?
Yes.
And tell us that story. That's a good story.
Well, they were debating many different titles of what to call the president, how to address the president. His Excellency, the defender of our rights and protector of our freedoms, all sorts of different titles. And George Washington ultimately says, just call me Mr. President.
Right. Now, didn't some people, though, think that Adams was a little bit too concerned with such things? And I believe one wag even suggested they refer to him as his rotundity.
Yes. those were some of the stories that came from that debate.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we're taking a fascinating tour of Congress Hall and other important historic buildings in Philadelphia with Ranger Adam Duncan of the National Park Service. After the break, we'll continue our tour of Congress Hall and beyond. Stay tuned.
I do believe you've laid a curse on North America, a curse that we here now rehearse in Philadelphia. A second flood, a simple famine, plagues of locusts everywhere, or a cataclysmic earthquake, I'd accept with some despair. But no, you sent us Congress. Good God, sir, was that fair?
This is Stuart Harris, and we're taking a tour of those buildings you may have overlooked in Philadelphia. We're going beyond Independence Hall to some of the other very important buildings in historic Philadelphia. Okay, we are now in the Senate Chamber in Congress Hall.
As you can tell, for the difference between the Senate Chamber and the House of Representatives Chamber, one, it's much smaller. Two, it's a lot more ornate. You see the red Moroccan leather on the chairs, whereas downstairs it was just that plain black leather. So it's a little bit fancier in here. Most of the chairs in this room are original to the time period, so that's why we really don't go past, the tours don't go past the rope here. Ultimately, a lot of events take place here in the 10 years. I probably talk for a lot longer than the show or anybody would want to listen to about any of the events that take place here in the room. But as I said earlier, it's the vice president who is the president of the Senate and presides. I believe that does not change until the 20th century, until maybe Nixon, mm-hmm. where he stops showing up, and then ultimately the president pro temp or other appointed member.
But even to this day, if the vice president shows up, he is the presiding officer.
He's the presiding officer. You'll see it mostly during, that's in the House.
Well, I remember Al Gore actually showed up
for the impeachment.
Well, he showed up actually to count the votes in the Electoral College in the election that he lost to George. Well, ultimately to George Bush in 2000, and he was serving in his capacity as the president of the Senate then, because of course he was vice president.
And if there were a tie, the vice president would show up. And some during the Constitutional Convention and constitutional scholars today challenge that, because isn't that a confliction between the executive branch and
the vice president, especially when he's presiding, is probably the officer that most violates the concept of separation of powers. But it's right there in the Constitution,
sure.
So it's kind of hard to argue with it.
I think if we were to stop one of the members, Doc Brown comes back with the DeLorean, and we go back in time, and we stop one of the members at the Constitutional Convention, and we ask them why, they would probably look at us and say, well, what else is the vice president going to do?
He doesn't have much else to do. You know, before you tell me any more stories, I've got to notice something here. Mm-hmm. I notice we have the lovely leather chairs here. They look reasonably comfortable. Mm-hmm. The ones downstairs that the House of Representatives sat in, those look reasonably comfortable. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you look at the chairs in the actual assembly room where the Constitution was drafted. Those were hard wooden chairs. Now, here's an interesting theory, and I've just come up with it. I am the progenitor of this theory. Maybe that's why the convention was able to get something done as quickly as it did, because they weren't comfortable. If your chairs are too comfortable, you tend just to sit there. But if they're not comfortable, by golly, you want to get something done and get out. That's an interesting constitutional theory.
You definitely have a very strong theory. These are padded chairs, whereas the others inside the assembly room are the Windsor-style Chippendale chairs.
Perhaps we should put those sorts of chairs in our Congress today, and then things would get done much more quickly.
Well, I could say Benjamin Franklin was overheard snoring during the Constitutional Convention, so those chairs might be a lot more comfortable than we imagine.
I see, at least if you're 80-some-odd years old. Okay.
Now, behind us, you will see a very large painting in the library of the Senate.
Oh, yes, yes.
A lot of people think that is Queen Charlotte, who was the Queen of England at the time. Everybody knows King George III. Queen Charlotte was his wife. It is not. It is actually Marie Antoinette, Queen of France.
Marie Antoinette, of course. Now, a lot of people may wonder why we would have Marie Antoinette's picture up there.
Remember, our greatest friend during the American Revolution was France.
That's right.
And Spain and the Netherlands, too.
Right.
But the French helped us the most. So they were gifts to Congress in the 1790s. And they were hung here on the wall. So on this side, we see Queen Marie Antoinette. And then on the other side, we'll see King Louis XVI.
Now, that's somewhat poignant because probably by the time those pictures got here, the people who sat for those portraits had both lost their heads in the terror.
Eventually, that would be their fate. When they're first mounted on the wall, the case is different. And this is a little bit before the French Revolution breaks out.
Yeah. I think that they were both beheaded in the early 1790s, so it probably
93, was not, 94.
Yeah, it was probably not long after that that they were hung, the paintings were hung, yeah.
Well, let's step back into the hallway, and we'll take a look at some of the other rooms here in the Senate chamber.
Okay. All right, now we're in the joint committee room.
And this would have been just one of your extra rooms when the Senate needed to break down into committees that they could use to discuss all sorts of things, you know, Ways and Means Committee, common room just to be used as needed.
Very interesting. Could you comment on the maps on the wall there? I see several eastern states with very extended western boundaries.
Certainly, the boundaries were disputed for a long period of time. In fact, under Penn's rule, Penn claimed down to Baltimore. Maryland claimed all the way out to Pittsburgh. Virginia claimed to the Pacific Ocean. So boundaries, and you remember during the Civil War, that's really where we get our final boundaries. When West Virginia, which was part of Virginia, Tennessee breaks off at this time, originally called the Colony of Franklin or the Franklin Territory.
Right. We just did a show on the lost state of Franklin.
Oh, really?
We broadcast from Johnson City, Tennessee, which is where the lost state of Franklin was pretty much headquartered, even though the capital was elsewhere.
Well, we also had one of your representatives here. Andrew Jackson.
Of course. Andrew Jackson was a member in the 1790s.
Yes.
So he was in this building. Now, and of course, as you've already mentioned, we had three states that were admitted to the Union in the 1790s. They were Vermont and Tennessee and Kentucky. Right?
And 1791, 1796, and 1798, I believe.
So it was right in this building where the Congress voted to admit those states.
Absolutely.
So this is the birthplace, in many respects, of those three states.
These three states, the rules that the House and the Senate would govern themselves, it's really where they take ink on paper and put it into practice. You know, you could talk all day long on how you're going to meet, but if you don't actually follow it and set guidelines, that's what they did here. They took the Constitution, what was done just 3 years before they came here, and really put it into effect. And I said earlier, it's one of the most tumultuous time periods because this new system of government, people were not quite sure if this was going to work. Mm-hmm. And it was Washington that was the glue that held it all together.
Yes, and you mentioned Washington, and I'm thinking this is where that famous encounter took place when Washington came over to discuss some legislative proposals with the Senate. And after seeing the cold reception he got at the Senate, he vowed he would never come back, right?
And that's correct.
Because the Senate, well, you tell the story. What happened?
You pretty much said it as in much great detail as I could say.
Okay, so and that's part of the big story here is that they're all figuring out how things are going to work. And Washington thought that there would be a much closer relationship between himself as president and the Senate, that they'd all kind of sit down and work together. And the Senate was having none of it. They said, you know, we're a separate branch of government or part of a separate branch. And quite frankly, we don't really need you over here.
Yeah, and they made him wait all day. Same instance, he once asked the Supreme Court for advice. And they said, well, Mr. President, we can't give you advice.
The opinion of the justices, that's one of the first cases we teach in constitutional law, extremely important. This is the time when the three separate branches of government decided to go their separate ways and to do their jobs independently. And that was a very, very important practice to put into effect, and it all happened right here.
Right here. And it's also, we're going to see in a minute, where the Supreme Court really gets started and set up. And remember, this is before Marbury versus Madison. This is before judicial review takes place.
Okay. Boy, this is exciting. Let's do it.
As Ranger Adam Duncan just said, our next destination is the building where the Supreme Court met. Now, it wasn't really built as a Supreme Court building. It was already being used by the Philadelphia city government. And indeed, that's kind of historically significant because, you know, the Supreme Court didn't have its own building until the 1930s. Alexander Hamilton once called the judiciary the least dangerous branch of the U.S. government, and it's certainly the branch of the government that over the years has gotten the least respect. In fact, during the decade of the 1790s, the court was at its lowest point in terms of its power and prestige. It had not yet established that enormous power of what we call judicial review. That wouldn't come until the 1800s. And so in a way, it's sort of dispiriting to look at the small, relatively unimpressive building where the Supreme Court met. But on the other hand, there were some important cases that were decided during that important decade, and it's certainly worth a couple of minutes at least.
All right, we're in the City Hall of Philadelphia. This is where the first Supreme Court met during the 1790s, right?
The first Supreme Court met here basically 2 months out of the year, February and August. Think about those months. February, Philadelphia is very cold, and August, Philadelphia is very hot. The rest of the time, they would be riding to the lower courts, the circuit. So it is not this prestigious job that it is today that any attorney and lawyer would aspire to obtain. In fact, there's a huge turnover in justices. And back then, you can count the chairs. You notice that the justices were a little bit smaller. There's only six at that time. And remember, that is a law that is passed by Congress. It is not set in the Constitution.
Right, exactly right. So they had six. I bet they probably had some tied votes.
I believe so.
Yeah, okay.
So. The docket isn't as clear back then. Mm-hmm. We don't know the absolute first decision, but their first decision of any weight was what we mentioned earlier, Chisholm versus Georgia.
Right, yes. And that happened in the 1790s. Right, wow, decided right in this room. It's a beautiful room. It's a relatively small room. It's mostly sort of an off-white, I guess.
Yeah, and you can see pictures on the National Parks website. So if any of the listeners want to really see what we're talking about, you go to www.nps.nationalparkservice.gov/INDE for independence. And that you'll see a photo gallery.
nps.gov/INDEP. Okay, INDE. Okay, great. And it is absolutely beautiful, but very simple, and a simple wooden floor. And this is where some very significant arguments took place. Of course, it did precede Marbury versus Madison, which happened in 1803.
This is probably one of the most unvisited sites, and we happen to come here when we just got about 90 or so people.
Yeah, our timing was a little bit off.
Okay. Was a little bit off. But this would have been the treasurer's office for the city of Philadelphia in the 1790s. And I want the listeners to really imagine, in the 1790s...
Wait a minute, this was the treasury building?
This is the treasury's office for Philadelphia.
Oh, for the city of Philadelphia. Okay.
The treasury building was down by the Bank of the United States, okay, just a few blocks away, for the federal government. But in the 1790s, you had, just on this block, city government, county government, state government, and federal government between Market and Walnut Street, 5th Street and 6th Street. So just very small geographical area.
Just remarkable. Absolutely remarkable. Okay. Well, it's kind of funny you should mention it, John Jay. You pointed out the plaque outside, and we didn't stop because it was raining, but it mentioned that this is where the Supreme Court first met, and the first three chief justices are mentioned on the plaque, John Jay.
John Rutledge.
And then Oliver Ellsworth. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that the first great Chief Justice was the fourth one, and that, of course, was John Marshall.
John Marshall, who was also Secretary of State.
Right, exactly. That's a whole other story, but the interesting thing is that John Jay was actually offered the job a second time. He could have come back to be the fourth Chief Justice, and he said, no, I'm not interested in taking a job that has no importance on a court that has no importance.
Yeah, and I believe John Jay left the Supreme Court to take a state office
right
in New York.
Exactly. And so, and then, of course, it was John Marshall who turned the Supreme Court into the enormously important institution it is today. But I see our crowd is coming in, so we'll cut this one off unless there's something you want to add.
Not at all.
Okay.
Now, the next and final building on our tour of some of the constitutionally significant buildings in Philadelphia is a place many of you may never have heard of. It is the Second Bank of the United States. Now, there's also a First Bank of the United States in Philadelphia. It's actually used for other purposes now. The Second Bank is still owned by the U.S. government and is administered by the National Park Service. And as you'll hear, a lot of it's been devoted to other uses. But why? What is this stuff? What are these First and Second Banks of the United States? Why are they important to the Constitution? Well, they're very important for a subject that we still argue about today, and that is so-called implied powers. Implied powers. Does the Constitution give the federal government power to do only those things that are very specifically mentioned in the Constitution, or does it also give implied power to do other things that aren't specifically mentioned? This has been a huge debate ever since the founding era, and it was in the seminal case of McCulloch versus Maryland, decided in the early 1800s, that the Supreme Court, led by John Marshall, the first great Chief Justice, decided that there are very significant implied powers. For example, if Congress is given the power to regulate commerce, then implicit within that power is the power to create a bank to assist with that regulation. Huge arguments over it, and let's go to the Second Bank of the United States now and hear a little bit about it.
Okay, we're standing in a rainstorm outside the Second Bank of the United States, which is just down the street from the Independence Hall complex. And Adam Duncan, our park ranger, has graciously agreed to come down and tell us a bit about this building.
All right, most people walk right past the two bank buildings, not really paying much attention to them. But they are part of the National Park. We cover about 25 buildings here in old Philadelphia. And the Second Bank of the United States houses today our portrait collection. We have about 190 works on display, done from the time period of the founding fathers and mothers. We do have a few portraits of women as well, including Martha Washington. But the Second Bank is perhaps better known by historians as being that monster as the 1832 presidential campaign referred to it by some sides. Of course, Andrew Jackson was opposed to the federal government being involved in banking. He's not the only one, and he's certainly not the first one. The argument would go back to where we were at Congress Hall and Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and Thomas Jefferson, and George Washington. You know, the Federalists believe the federal government should be involved in banking, that the federal government has, in what's called the inherent and proper clauses in the Constitution, the authority to regulate the financial institutions. Whereas others like Madison and Jefferson, they felt that the Constitution did not specifically give the power to the government to create a bank, so therefore the government does not have the power to do it. Well, ultimately, George Washington sides with Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton gives him a very strong argument to sign the legislation chartering a Bank of the United States for 20 years.
That was the First Bank of the United States.
That is what we now call the First Bank.
Right.
But not first in terms of the absolute first bank in the country.
Right.
The first national bank.
Right, okay.
Today we would call it the Federal Reserve.
Right.
Well, that argument kind of dies off a little bit, and then in 1811, the federal government feels, well, the economy's stable, things are looking good, we're paying off our debts, why do we really need a bank? They let the charter lapse. Of course, 1812, we get the War of 1812.
And then they realize it would have been a very good idea to have a little bit of money that the federal government could have tapped into very quickly.
Yes.
Given that there was an invading British army on the way.
Very much so. So ultimately what happens is by 1816, it takes a little bit of time, Congress recharters the Bank of the United States. Now, the federal government had already sold the old Bank of the United States, the physical location of it.
That's also here in Philadelphia.
Yeah, it's about another block down from us, to Stephen Girard. And it was the Stephen Girard Bank all the way up into the 1950s. So they had to build a new bank, a new structure to house the Bank of the United States. So that's why we call where we're standing the second bank. It's actually the second physical location for the Bank of the United States. It is mostly the original building. It did become the U.S. Customs House after the bank closes, because remember, the 1832 presidential campaign, Jackson vows that if Congress tries to pass new legislation rechartering the bank, he would veto it. And that's exactly what he did in 1836. The bank closed its doors. Congress could never muster the two-thirds override for the veto.
Wow. And so, of course, we didn't have a U.S. official bank until effectively about 1913, I think it was.
1913 is when the Federal Reserve
was created. And of course, it traces its roots back to this one.
Now, some years ago, I was working this building, and it was a rainstorm much like this one, and I happened to be standing outside to watch what was going on. And a huge 300-person protest comes up, and they come up one of the steps right here, and they start holding the signs. They were protesting the Federal Reserve Bank. And I look at them, and I said, guys, the Federal Reserve Bank is a couple blocks that way. We haven't been the Federal Reserve over here since 1836. So they went away a little embarrassed, but very happy I pointed them in the right direction.
Well, I'm glad you did, too.
So that debate continues today. Does the federal government in the Constitution have the power and the authority to regulate finances?
And as I'm sure you know, this was a huge, big case, McCulloch versus Maryland, where John Marshall, the fourth Chief Justice of the United States, resoundingly said that the states did not have the power to tax this bank, and that the U.S. government did, in fact, have the power to create it. Very, very famous, very, very important case, and here it is. We're standing on the steps.
Yeah,
I'm just quivering with excitement.
And I think Jackson, been alive, as he once said about the Supreme Court, and I believe it was Taney, he says, where's your army to enforce your rulings? I have the army.
That's a whole nother issue, you're right.
If they tried to force him to keep the bank open anyways.
Wow. Okay.
Let's go in.
Okay, let's go in.
But before we go in, we need to take a short break. When we come back, the inside of the Second Bank of the United States.
You see, we piddle, twiddle, and resolve. Not one damn thing do we solve. Piddle, twiddle, and resolve. Nothing's ever solved in foul, fetid, fuming, foggy, filthy Philadelphia.
Someone ought to open up a window.
Good God! They may sit here for years and years in Philadelphia. These indecisive grenadiers of...
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, where we continue our tour of historic Philadelphia. Now we're about to go inside the Second Bank of the United States, and just maybe we'll find some of that national treasure.
Okay, we're inside the Second Bank of the United States.
The original floor plan is still intact, as William Strickland, the architect, designed it. Some of the stairwell locations have changed. So we would have the president's office over here. You would also have tellers. We don't know exactly physically how the interior was set up. If there were tellers, if it was just certain aspects. There's no account of what the interior really looked like. It's only through architectural evidence that we established, that this is the original, according to the original drawings of William Strickland. Paint colors, again, we did a paint exploration and determined that the original color was salmon.
Okay, and sort of a pinkish color. Yeah, okay.
When you walk in, it's a very large barrel vaulted ceiling. And
it is.
You can see there's groin vaults here.
This is gorgeous. This is beautiful interior design and a beautiful architecture.
And the clock's still original.
Wow. Oh, that is gorgeous.
3 million bricks used in this half barrel.
Wow. It is a huge vault, and it goes from left to right as you walk in the building, and it has are they Doric columns, or one of those kind of columns, or Roman-style columns, or Greek-style columns, and it looks very, very much
I believe they're Ionic.
Ionic,
They could be Doric. Not Corinthian.
I don't even know the difference. They're just they're columns. They're big marble columns, and they are. This looks very much like a Bank of the United States should look.
Yeah, and the back room is the stockholders' office. Today, the setup's a little bit different. There would have been smaller offices back there, but it's been enlarged. After the bank closed, it became the United States Customs Office for 99 years until the 1930s. when the national, when I should say the Department of the Interior was given the building, and then in turn, Interior gave it to the National Park Service.
You said the stockholders' office, and that's a very important point because the United States did not own the bank entirely. I think it was about 20%, right?
Yeah.
And the other 80% was made up of private investors, and that was one of the things that people like Jefferson and Jackson later really, really objected to, because it was the idea that the rich, powerful people were going to get some sort of quasi-official status and were going to control the money in the economy.
The rich would get richer and the poor would get poorer.
Right, and that's exactly what they were concerned about.
And he thought this was a many-headed monster. There was also branches throughout the country,
right.
One, I believe, in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "It's trying to kill me, but I will kill it first."
And he did.
He did.
Didn't want to mess with Andrew Jackson. Let's go and see about that.
The old exhibit actually had currency and notes from the bank. But this is a tribute not only to Jackson, but also to one of the bank's presidents. And I believe he was the last president, Nicholas Biddle. And Mr. Biddle successfully turned this into a state bank for a few years, and then ultimately that closed.
Bailey Banks and Biddle is a famous store here in Philadelphia. Is that the same Biddle family?
It may be. There's actually, you'll see several portraits of different Biddles.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's a connection. I don't know what it is.
Okay, understood.
Behind us, you'll see the original layout, the floor plan.
Right.
And it's not too much different. So this is where we came in.
Right.
And we are over here in the assistant cashier's room.
I see.
And then there's the stockholders' office, and then the two smaller committee rooms.
Where did they keep the money?
Money would have been stored downstairs.
Downstairs in a vault?
The big stores of gold and silver bullion. The day stuff, the small specie, as it was called. Remember, Jackson said he never trusted anything more than a $20. It would have been kept in the day vaults.
See, that's very important because in that day and age, unlike now, most money physically existed. I mean, there was a gold coin, or there was a piece of bullion, or there was a note, a piece of paper.
And but it was backed with gold and silver.
Yeah, there was a physical existence. And, of course, these days, any economist will tell you the vast number of dollars in our economy in any given moment are little electronic blips on somebody's computer.
Yep.
But in those days, it physically existed, so you had to have a vault here.
And if you take a look, this is where the small stores... Because remember, that was the assistant cashier's room.
Right.
So you have a vault in the wall. It looks like just a simple wood door, but it's not. It's cast iron. So this could defeat any sort of black powder of the day.
That's very, very sturdy, yes.
When the door is closed, you have these pins that drop into a cast iron frame.
And this is about, it looks almost a foot thick, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there would have been shelves here.
Right.
They could keep, money reserves.
I am standing in the vault, at least one of the day vaults of the Second Bank of the United States, me and the ghosts of all that money. Okay.
I would take you down into the main vaults, but they don't give me the key to that one.
All right,
because
I understand.
Because we store a very precious commodity in those vaults, and they don't want anybody having access to it.
And what would that commodity be?
Toilet paper.
The government always finds a use for its buildings. Okay, and now, of course, as you've already told me, this is a portrait gallery, and I recognize a few of these portraits. Who are they?
Certainly. Right now we're in what we call Peale's Museum, Charles Wilson Peale. He was a contemporary of the founders and the framers. In fact, he knew them well, including George Washington. He served under Washington at Princeton. And Peale is a family, him and his family, they're artists. Mm-hmm. He has 17 kids, all are artists.
He didn't spend all of his time painting.
No, he had three wives.
Wow.
They did not have longevity,
mm-hmm.
And his wives died mostly due to complications of pregnancy.
Well, okay, all joking aside, it was a tough time for women in the 18th century.
It was. It was a tough time for anybody, but especially for women and minorities. But this room really kind of captures Peale's museum. Charles Wilson Peale opens the first museum in the United States. It was first housed in Philosophical Hall in the 1790s. So at the time that where those buildings that we just were, Philosophical Hall, it's just behind Independence Hall, Congress Hall, and Old City Hall. So when the members of Congress, the members of the court, or the president are going to their buildings, they pass Peale's Museum. And even Thomas Jefferson had a subscription. He tries to get government sponsorship. He doesn't. Actually, not until the National Park Service takes over his collection in 1948.
Jefferson was often ahead of his time, wasn't he?
He was.
Okay.
And Peale is kind of, I don't want to compare him to anybody because he's very unique, but P.T. Barnum would be very close because Barnum buys a lot of Peale's collection. He had stuffed animals in his collection. We see a stuffed bald eagle. He had things from Lewis and Clark. They were mailing them back. In fact, Philadelphia was the staging area for Lewis and Clark.
Huh.
This is where they got their medical training and they bought their supplies that they would need for the trip. And it's also they're communicating with Charles Wilson Peale. They're communicating with several of the Bartrams, William and John Bartram, a very famous family. And we have a portrait of them here in this collection. So Peale painted not only people, but he collected specimens. He felt that the art and the birds and the beasts will teach thee. He had a live grizzly bear in his collection. In fact, the live grizzly bear once got out when the museum was over behind Independence Hall. And so you can imagine, if you're a member of Congress, there's a live grizzly bear running around. He ended up having to shoot it because it got into his kitchen and started rummaging through his kitchen.
Exciting day.
After Philadelphia leaves after the Capitol leaves Philadelphia, not only for the United States, but also for the state of Pennsylvania, Charles Wilson Peale in 1802 moves into the second floor of Independence Hall, where we were a little bit earlier.
Really?
In that long gallery where the ratification committee ratified the Constitution for Pennsylvania. He used that area as well as his studio, too. But he originally started as a commission artist, and later he just gets into doing works just solely for his museum, and his sons would also paint, and his daughters and some of his relatives. His brother was also an artist too.
And it looks like he painted, it looks at a glance like he painted every single founder.
Just about.
Yeah.
Lewis and Clark, I am told that we have the only from life portraits of Lewis and Clark, and in fact every image I've ever seen are the two works that we have here. So there's some pretty rare stuff. People come in, oh, they're just prints.
These are the originals.
These are the originals, done from life.
Wow.
We have one of Rufus King over there. Rufus King was actually his favorite portrait that he ever painted. He said he did it in about 2 hours, and it was done down in Washington. And Mr. King did not have a whole lot of time. And so Peale said, no worries, and painted him out in two hours.
Which one is he?
It's number 59 right there.
59, and that was his favorite picture of himself.
Yeah, he said, well, that was Charles Wilson Peale's favorite picture that he ever painted.
Oh, I see, Charles Wilson Peale's
favorite. Yeah, because he said picture. He did it so quickly and so accurately.
He did that in 2 hours?
2 hours.
That looks like a photograph.
It does.
It looks like a photograph.
And you could tell the earlier works of Peale because he was using copper oxide in his
right?
paints. He was not a formally trained artist. This is natural talent. You could see some of the older works have kind of oxidized and have that green, morbid
right.
look to
yeah.
them. So you could tell those are the earlier ones. The later ones have those nice flesh, rosy colors to them. His son becomes Rembrandt. He named his son Rembrandt. becomes a very formal painter, and he is taught how to mix paint properly. So he teaches his father later on how to do it. So you really see that different time period. Charles Thompson, number 43, this was one of his favorites. He actually painted Mr. Thompson as a young man. If you would have looked closely at the printed copy of the Declaration of Independence, you would have seen two names on it, John Hancock and Charles Thompson. He is the secretary of pretty much the U.S. government until the U.S. Constitution goes into effect.
Wow. And this is not a flattering picture of him. It's pretty clear looking at this picture that the man had lost his teeth.
Yeah, and he was about in his 80s.
Yeah.
Peale, you can see by most of his works, he does not put too many things in his portraits.
Right.
There's not a whole lot of detail, plain, simple background, and just the person as he saw them, as they presented themselves to him. if he does have an object, there's some significance to it. I could tell you the story about Charles Thompson is he was well known for his cane and using that cane on the floor of Congress.
Using it how?
you could imagine we would probably call him today the enforcer.
Oh, my goodness. And that's the one he used. Okay.
That's what he was famous for.
Very good. Now, do you have a picture of Governor Morris here?
We do have one of Governor Morris. It is not a peel, and it's not done from life. It's
oh, okay.
One of a few later works.
Okay.
But it is one based off of an original.
Well, that's okay.
But it's only a body
picture. What are some of the more famous pictures you might have here?
One of my favorites, if any of the listeners have ever seen the movie National Treasure, they will be told about Charles Carroll, the last signer of the Declaration to die. I believe he died in 1832. Yep. And he was the last one.
Which one is that? Which picture?
This is number 8. Right
number 8.
This. And if we take a few steps to the side, you get a really good, clear view of it.
Yes, that's a very good picture. How do you feel about that National Treasure movie?
Well, I worked here when they were filming it.
And they filmed it here?
The Philadelphia scenes when the interior of Independence Hall is actually Knott's Berry Farms out in California, but all the exterior was filmed here. I have very strong feelings about the movie. I really enjoy it. Remember, it's Hollywood. It is a movie. Even 1776 is inaccurate.
Oh, of course.
But the thing about the movie is it makes history fun. And I think that's the most important thing. When I was in high school, I was like, man, history's so boring.
Right.
And it wasn't until college. I had a college professor that really got me excited about history. Because you could watch all the TV shows you want. Most of those are just a figment of somebody's imagination, the writer, what he can come up with. These stories in American history are true, and they're probably more entertaining than any movie or TV show you can watch today.
So although National Treasure is, these movies are obviously fiction, you think that anything that will inspire people to be interested in history
and to want to learn more. That's the most important thing, education. Absolutely.
Well, I hope that that's the case. I hope it'll inspire people to learn the true story. But there's a part of me that's afraid that when they see movies like that, they'll think there really were some terrible conspiracies back
there
in the day.
Well, we do see those, but we get those without movies as well. So,
that's true. All right. But as you point out, even one of my favorite movies, 1776, is not entirely accurate. And it's certainly not accurate that people were singing and dancing during the during the Declaration of Independence's adoption.
Yeah, and the John Adams, the HBO series. Well done. Excellent, excellent series. There were a few inaccuracies in it.
Really?
So, you know, entertainment and absolute correctness, it's a delicate balance.
Understood.
I think the most entertainment in my mind is to pick up a book and seek out all these events. Mm-hmm. Learn it firsthand. Look at primary sources. Look at their letters that they wrote to each other. If you want a great source of entertainment, read Alexander Hamilton's letters to Aaron Burr and vice versa. But go back and pick up some biographies. Governor Morris. There's great books on Governor Morris.
Yeah, fascinating character.
Yeah, I believe one of my favorites is called The Rake That Wrote the Constitution.
Ranger Adam Duncan of the National Park Service and the Independence Hall area, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
And
I'll have to come back sometime.
We'll be happy to have you.
Thanks.
And that's our show for today. It pains me again that once again we've got to leave Philadelphia before our tour is over, because there's one other major place I really want you to hear about, and that's called the National Constitution Center. It's right across Independence Mall from Philadelphia. I've got some great interviews over there, some great segments, but we're going to have to wait till a future episode to hear them. In the meantime, my name is Stuart Harris. My producer is Wayne Winkler, and I want to thank the National Park Service. I want to thank Ranger Adam Duncan, especially, for all the time he spent with us in Philadelphia. And I want to remind you that we are on iTunes, so you can listen to our podcast at your convenience. We're also on Facebook, and hey, we're even on Twitter, because though we think the 18th century is important, we live in the 21st century, at least most of the time. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.